And now it's time for us to catch up on stories that have been making headlines around the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, going on a sustainable safari in Kenya and the Dutch university with plans to grow food on the moon. But first to Paris. It was another significant moment in the ongoing reconstruction of the fire-devastated Notre Dame. Crowds gathered along the Seine to watch a crane lift 12-metre-high wooden trusses onto the rooftop of the cathedral after they were transported along the river by barge. Constructed by hand using the same methods employed by medieval carpenters, the beams will now be fitted together to rebuild the rooftop ravaged by the blaze that tore through the monument in April 2019. From Paris, Sharon Gaffney reports.
Look at my arms, I have goosebumps. Jacques Naomi says he's been dreaming of this moment since he started training for the job 4 years ago. Surrounded by scaffolding, the carpenter is perched on the rooftop of the building site, better known as the world-famous Cathedral of Notre Dame. He's part of a team of highly skilled artisan workers painstakingly restoring the fire-ravaged monument that overlooks the Seine in central Paris. This week, they've been slotting into position the massive oak trusses that will be fitted together to recreate what's described as the backbone of the cathedral. Running the length of the nave and transept above the stone vaults, the wooden framework will support the building's new roof after the centuries-old original was destroyed by the blaze that ripped through Notre Dame in April 2019. Guided by ropes, the 12-metre-high triangular beams, each weighing over 7 tonnes, were hoisted by crane directly onto the rooftop after being transported on barges along the Seine. In tribute to the craftsmanship of those who built the historic monument and to ensure that the beams bear the same markings as the original wooden frame, the trusses were made entirely by hand by carpenters in the Loire Valley in western France. Carved from the trunks of ancient oak trees with the same kind of axes that were used in the Middle Ages. 60 of them were forged especially for the task and stamped with an image of the cathedral. While remaining faithful to the medieval techniques mastered in the 12th century, the labour-intensive reconstruction of Notre Dame incorporates a 21st century twist. As it rises from the ashes, the renovated monument will feature cutting-edge fire prevention technology, including blaze-resistant doors, thermal cameras, and misting systems. 800 years on, certain elements of the building's original construction remain shrouded in mystery, but the restoration works have shed some new light on the process that began in the year 1163 when the foundation stone was laid by Pope Alexander III. In the absence of detailed plans, architects have long speculated about how the cathedral's thin walls were able to support its huge vaulted roof, which rose to a then unprecedented height of 32 metres. The fire that engulfed the church 4 years ago exposed hundreds of previously hidden iron staples that were used to hold the stone blocks together. The discovery suggesting that Notre Dame was the first Gothic cathedral to feature the extensive use of such metal reinforcements. As Jacques and his team manoeuvre the oak trusses into position on the rooftop, they're awaiting the return of one of the most recognisable characteristics of Gothic architecture. Not all of the cathedral's grimacing guardians survived the fire. The gargoyles intended to protect the building from evil and the wrath of the heavens are being restored and transported back to their rightful perch. Others are being replaced by models made from clay and stone. Not purely decorative, the ornamental statues are an important element of the building's drainage system, used to redirect rainwater from the roof. Far below their watchful gaze, passers-by stopped to peer towards the skies at what the French Transport Minister described as a simply magical moment on Tuesday. With the pivotal supports now firmly in place, the focus will soon shift to the cathedral's replacement spire. While some had favoured a more modern design, it's set to look exactly as it did before the blaze, carved from oak and covered in lead. Its 80-tonne wooden base has already been installed. The retired Army General appointed by President Macron to oversee the reconstruction of Notre Dame says the silhouette of the cathedral, including the replica spire, will once more be visible along the Paris skyline by the end of this year. Despite the logistical challenges posed by the Games, the restoration work is set to push on through next summer's Olympics, with the monument on track to reopen to worshippers and visitors by December 2024. For World Report in Paris, this is Sharon Gaffney.
Next we go to Kenya, where sustainable safari camps are being promoted on the open plains of the Masai Mara. It's an effort to ensure that visitors can stay in ecologically friendly accommodation, which does not harm the wildlife or the environment, as Connor Power reports from Kenya.
On the face of it, flying people in from all over the world to view Kenya's extraordinary wildlife doesn't seem like the most sustainable or eco-friendly business model. But from the perspective of the people in Kenya, a country where plastic bags have been completely banned for 6 years now, the effort can only be applied on the ground. I visited three safari camps belonging to the Porini group, all of which feature ecologically friendly tent accommodation located within conservancies. The conservancy is a concept dreamed up in the 90s by one of the founders of Porini in an attempt to ensure the long-term coexistence of the country's wildlife, tourism and local communities. The conservancy differs from a national park in a number of crucial ways. The national park is a state-owned institution and run by local government. The conservancy is a private organisation, renting lands that are owned by a variety of people, which sometimes include the state itself. On the face of it, the two models are pretty much the same, and one would assume that the national park should be a safer haven for animals rather than an area run by private interests. However, the conservancy model runs on stricter and more efficiently run principles. One of the main principles is that the local people benefit from the profits generated by tourism. Traditional Maasai cattle farmers, for example, get to continue herding cattle alongside the wild animals, practical biodiversity that they've practiced for generations, while getting paid a monthly rental income. They also have the opportunity to work as guides in their own backyard, which many of them do. Secondly, the long-term and sustainable vision of the conservancy setup is to limit the impact of tourism. The difference doesn't become clear until you visit both. In the vast area of the Masai Mara in the south of the country, a sea of land extends beyond as far as your eye can see, stretching over the border with Tanzania, from which point onwards it becomes the Serengeti. Within the Masai Mara, there is roughly equal mixture of conservancy lands and national park lands. The wild animals roam freely across the savanna landscape between both, and poaching has thankfully all but disappeared in both. I spent the morning in the Mara National Park with my two local Maasai warrior guides, Julius and John. Driving around the area, there seemed to be less animal density than in the conservancy where I was the day before. It's when there's an animal sighting, however, that I see a more dramatic difference. Up on a rise along one of the dirt roadways, there are about 10 jeeps of varying colours gathered around a tree. We drive up to see what they're all looking at. By the time we inch our way forward to get a ringside view of the pride of 16 lions that are sleeping under the tree, I count 22 jeeps. Any sound the lions might be making is drowned out by the constant clicking of cameras, the excited chatter of tourists, and the sound of safari jeeps and vans arriving and departing. "That was nothing," John says as we leave. "When it gets busier in July, you can have up to 100 vehicles at the sighting." That evening, we set out for a game drive in the Olari Oruk Conservancy. In the warm afternoon sun, we come across a lioness stalking a herd of wildebeest just across the stream from us. Incredulously, we watch the scene unfold from our cinematic viewpoint as the lioness, with the help of two more, brings down one of the wildebeest who has made the fatal mistake of splitting from the herd. Over the course of the next hour, the successful hunter walks back to fetch the rest of the pride, 11 in total, who arrive and feast together on their prey. Before we depart, as the sun is setting, I note that the whole scene has been witnessed by no more than 4 jeeps, all keeping a respectable distance. With migration corridors and more conservancies joining together, the animals of Kenya's great wilderness areas are free to choose where they wish to live. According to the latest detailed animal census carried out in the Masai Mara by the Wildlife Research and Training Institute and supported by the World Wildlife Fund in 2021, some 84% of all the Mara's wild animals choose to live in the conservancies rather than in the national parks. In the Maasai tradition, we believe that there is only one animal that is truly dangerous: humans. So says Ben, another incredibly knowledgeable and passionate Maasai warrior guide. Wise words, which only serve to underline the fact that in Kenya, as elsewhere, ideas of sustainability and biodiversity have existed since time immemorial, and for certain Kenyans have always been a matter of life and death. For World Report in the Maasai Mara, Kenya, this is Connor Power.
Finally, to the Netherlands, where scientists have their gaze directed towards the skies above them and towards solving one of the great problems associated with the future of space travel. Space agencies in China, Europe and the United States are planning to have people living and working on the moon and eventually on Mars. Private businesses run by billionaires are also involved in projects to create lunar and Martian colonies. One of the biggest challenges will be providing enough food for the settlements, and that means developing the ability to grow crops on another planet. Botanists have been conducting experiments to cultivate plants in soil from the moon, and a Dutch university says it has succeeded, as Russell Padmore reports from the Netherlands.
If bases are established on the moon as a stepping stone to Mars, it won't be viable to keep launching rockets to supply the lunar or Martian residents with food. It will have to be grown locally. And botanic research centres around the world have been experimenting to grow crops in moon soil, which is known as regolith. Wageningen University here in the east of the Netherlands is renowned for research to advance farming, but it's also developed a way to grow plants in soil from another planet. I decided to see these crops for myself, and after a drive of about 90 minutes from Eindhoven, I arrived at WUR in Wageningen. This Dutch university has many greenhouses for agricultural research. One of the buildings here is used by Vega Warmlink, an ecologist who started experiments 10 years ago using simulated moon soil or regolith. As we talked, he was carefully tending each plant in dozens of pots laid out in several rows. He explained that moon soil is very sharp and it cuts into the roots of the plants. The soil is also laced with toxins. The crops will be irrigated with recycled wastewater, which is why Vega Warmlink has tested human urine on some plants. He also told me water will come from ice on the moon and Mars. In October 1957, the former Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first ever satellite. And then, in 1961, the cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin successfully orbited the Earth. This prompted an ambitious commitment by US President John F. Kennedy. In 1961, JFK said America would send astronauts to the moon. And in 1969, the message from Apollo 11 that the Eagle has landed fulfilled that commitment. Neil Armstrong, the first astronaut on the moon, predicted that a permanent lunar presence would happen soon. But we're only getting close to that more than 50 years later. The advance of China's space program, alongside investment by billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, has breathed new life into the idea of establishing bases on the moon as a stepping stone to Mars. In 2019, China landed a craft on the far side of the lunar body with an experiment on board to grow cotton seeds. The Norwegian mining company Solstice is investigating ways to dig for metals on the moon, and it's also conducting research into growing plants there. Ethel Tolentino, the chief executive at Solstice in Oslo, told me that using hydroponics, cultivating crops in water, may be successful. 20 years ago, Keith Cowing, a space biologist, organised an experiment to grow crops on Devon Island, a remote territory in northern Canada. It was chosen to simulate the challenge of cultivating plants in isolation on another planet. He told me that monitoring the plants remotely was easy with cameras over the internet. Amusingly, he said another lesson learned was to build sturdy greenhouses to stop hungry bears breaking in. Here in Wageningen, the Dutch botanist Vega Warmlink believes that building greenhouses in caves on the moon may be necessary, And that idea is supported by Professor Andrew Palmer at the Florida Institute of Technology. He told me, "You're sheltered away from the radiation and temperature changes tend to be more stable." Professor Palmer also revealed their experiments to grow crops in moon soil or regolith have led to ways to remove toxic salts, useful for farmers on Earth. So after 10 years of experiments here in the Netherlands, which plants thrived in lunar or Martian soil? Potatoes like the Mars soil simulant, and potatoes are doing well, according to Vega Varmlink. And he said most of the plant species worked, only spinach gave us some problems. The Netherlands isn't usually seen as a centre of research for space missions, but Vega Varmlink's research here at Wageningen University to develop the best way to grow crops in Moon and Mars soil is ready to be put into practice. The last astronaut left footprints in the lunar soil in December 1972. More than half a century later, scientists planning for a permanent lunar presence are very dependent on biologists creating a successful way to grow crops on another planet. I'm Russell Padmore in Wageningen in the Netherlands for World Report.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.